now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
If you're a business owner who's hiring, you probably face a lot of challenges when it comes to finding the right person for your role, like not enough applicants with the right skills or experience, or too many resumes to sort through, yet you need to hire as soon as possible, or not knowing where to post your job to reach the right people. That's why hiring can feel like trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/murder. When you post a job on ZipRecruiter, it gets sent to over 100 top job sites with one click. Then ZipRecruiter's matching technology finds people with the right skills and experience for your job and actively invites them to apply. In fact, ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. It's no wonder over 2.3 million businesses have come to ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs. So while other companies overwhelm you with way too many options, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for, the needle in the haystack. And right now you can try ZipRecruiter for free at this web address, ZipRecruiter.com/murder. Once again, remember to go to this unique place, ZipRecruiter.com/MURDER. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Wealthy, beautiful, and brilliant. Michelle Danishevsky had fulfillment at her fingertips. Having conquered Wall Street, she was eager to build a family with her much younger husband, promising Ivy League graduate Rod Coughlin. But when his hidden vices surfaced, marital harmony gave way to a merciless divorce. Rod had long depended on Shell's income to fund his tastes for high-stakes backgammon and infidelity, and she finally vowed to sever him from her will. In late December 2009, Shell made an appointment with her lawyer to block him from her millions. She would never make it to that meeting. 2 days later on New Year's Eve, Shell was found dead in the bathtub of her Upper West Side apartment. Police ruled it an accident, and Shell's deeply Orthodox Jewish family quickly buried her without an autopsy on religious grounds. Rod had a clear path to his ex-wife's fortune, but suspicions about her death lingered. As the two families warred over custody of Shell's children and their inheritance, Rod concocted a series of increasingly demented schemes, even plotting to kill his own parents to secure the treasure. And as investigators closed in, Rod committed a final desperate act to frame his own daughter for her mother's death. Journalists Rebecca Rosenberg and Selim Algar reconstruct the 10 years that passed between the day Shell was found dead and the day her killer faced justice in this riveting account of how one man's irrepressible greed devolved into obsession, manipulation, and murder. The book that we're featuring this evening is At Any Cost with my special guest, Selim Algar. Welcome to the program and thank you very much for this interview, Selim Algar.
Thank you for having me, Dan. I appreciate it.
I apologize that we didn't have time to get the proper pronunciation of the certain name. So is there any name in that opening description synopsis that I mispronounced?
It's Shelley Danishevsky and Rod Coughlin. Those are the two main players in the book, Dan.
Right. Okay. Thank you for that correction. I thought that might be the case. And we didn't have time for me to get that straightened out. Let's start by how you came and co-author Rebecca Rosenberg, your wife, to how you both came to this story. Tell us about your journalistic background and why this story in particular, and you felt the need to write this book at any cost.
Well, it's a pretty straightforward origin, Dan. My wife, Rebecca, covers Manhattan criminal court for the New York Post, and she covered the trial from gavel to gavel. And I'm also a reporter at the same newspaper at the Post. I cover the New York City Department of Education, and my focus is on education issues. But when she was considering this topic for a book, we sort of quickly realized, or she did, that it would be easier with, we have 2 kids, so it might be a bit more manageable with a helping hand. And so I was enlisted in the effort, and we had a pretty quick turnaround on the deadline. And so two sets of hands on the laptops were better than one, I suppose. So that's how it began.
Great. Now you take us to, as you do in the book, to New Year's Eve 2009, and a young girl named Anna Kovlin, 9 years old, and her brother Miles, who's 3, and Shelley, their mother. And this is in the middle of the night. So as you do in the book, take us to this scene where young Anna gets up and wants to know where her mother is and goes looking.
It was early morning and the sun was not yet up, but Anna heard some water. She was awakened by the sound of rushing water nearby. She was in bed with her younger brother, who was still sleeping. But when she awoke, she noticed that her mother, who she climbed into bed with, was no longer in the bed. So obviously, as little kids are wont to do, she went to look for her, and her brother Miles eventually joined her because her sort of activity awoke him. And they went to the bathroom in there. It's an apartment in Manhattan where they lived. And she looked in, peered into the bathroom, and saw her mom and with her back towards her, and just thought that she was taking a night bath to sort of de-stress. Shelley, her mother, was a hardworking and accomplished woman, and I thought that she was just taking a night bath. So went back to bed. But then when they woke up a few hours later, now the sun is up, she went back in to the bathroom and saw her mother in the bathtub with reddened water and clearly not moving, in an obvious state of, I guess, not distress, but it was obvious that something was wrong.
Now, she has a situation where her father is living across the hall in a studio apartment, but she has permission to call her father if there's anything gone wrong or anything happens. So she does call that number and calls him. So what happens with that phone call? What does she tell her father, and what does he do?
So her mother, Shelley, and her father, Rod, were in the midst of a divorce, but like many couples who are in that situation, they sought to make it as easy as possible on the kids. And so he took up residence across the hall in an apartment in order to, you know, to whenever there was visitation, he could just come over and see them. So it was out of convenience. So obviously, Anna knew that her dad was across the way and called him. I think it was roughly 7 o'clock in the morning at this point, and told him that something's wrong with mommy. And obviously, hearing that, he darted over across the hall and came into the apartment.
So he performs some CPR, as you write, and shortly after calls 911. The operator guides him through more steps of CPR before he dispenses with that.
Mm-hmm.
What else does he do while he's waiting? You know, many people are familiar with someone having the wherewithal to not touch a crime scene because they've watched television and the procedure and the things that could happen. So, but what does he do?
He, like you recounted, he attempted to perform CPR, and he called 911, and the dispatcher try to guide him through it, but it was pretty clear early on that these attempts were futile. And at that point, there was little more to do than to await the emergency crews to arrive. And he put the kids in a separate bedroom to sort of shield them from what was taking place. And initially, when he went into the bathroom, he lifted Shelley out of the water and placed her on the bathroom floor before, you know, trying to administer CPR and calling 911. So it was clear that she had likely passed at that point, and there was little more for him to do than just to await the emergency crews, the FDNY and the NYPD, who were en route to the scene.
You write about EMS, 4 EMS members, and then people from the firefighters as well. So there was a person named Casey. What did first responders, 2 of them, William Ricks, a firefighter, and Casey, a member named Casey, mm-hmm. what did they notice about Shelley initially right on the floor, and where was Rod when they came to the scene?
So when they came in, he was in the bathroom near Shelley, and you know, these are veteran big city, New York City first responders. You have members mm-hmm. of FDNY and members of NYPD. So it's not, obviously they deal with extreme situations every day. So they pretty quickly recognized that Shelley was likely dead after, you know, they checked her for rigor mortis, and the limbs had set at this point. And it was clear to them what had taken place. And then that's sort of when the police take over. The FDNY left, the firefighters who come to really most emergency scenes left, and the investigation sort of began at that point. And the first person who arrived, though, was a firefighter. And so sort of a poignant scene, you know, he opens this door, and he looks down and sees a little girl looking at him. And, you know, he asks her, you know, what's happening? And she just points down the hallway. She doesn't say anything. And that's when he comes upon Rod and Shelley.
You write, too, that Rod directs New York Police Department officers to a cabin in the bathroom above the faucet that has been partially ripped from its hinges.
Mm-hmm.
And he immediately has the wherewithal to say, I think she may have grabbed a piece of wood from the cabinet and fell and hit her head. So he's offering what happened and also offering and suggesting that this was purely an accident. So he tells these first responders that and says, I can't believe this is happening. And he also tells them that his wife had taken out a restraining order against him and then that he had lived close to be near the children, however. Mm-hmm. With this information that the NYPD get, what else do police do at that crime scene at that time?
So this was sort of obviously early on one of the major aspects of the case, that they had sort of a rough sense of the situation in that they were in the middle of a divorce. There was a restraining order in place, that he lived across the hall. And obviously, in those circumstances, people would assume that they would train their sort of focus on him in case there was indeed any foul play or anything suspicious about the circumstances.
Right.
But he sort of preempted a lot of that, it seems, by offering rather quickly this explanation. There was a cabinet in the bathroom that had been dislodged from the wall, and he told them that perhaps she had lost her balance or slipped in some manner, and in doing so sort of grasped this fixture and ripped it off the hinge, fell, and hit her head. But it was obviously a heavy critique early on of the detectives and the police officers at the scene for not sort of doing a more thorough probe. They didn't sort of entertain foul play really as an option early on. And that would sort of play at the trial. That would play a major role at trial.
There's another important character. There's been a nanny that's been with the family right since the birth of Anna, and she's 9 years old. So she's been with the family for 9 years and is the principal caregiver for this family. And her name is Hyacinth Reed, or she goes by the name Rose, and she's a Jamaican woman. And she arrives at the apartment just after 8 with her grandson to play with the children as well, her grandson JJ. She asks right away where the kids are and asks where Shelley was. Mm-hmm. And the police are there as well, and Rod is there. And what is the response to her questions? And then what does she have to say?
So Hyacinth Reed, or Rhodes, was an integral part of this family, their day-to-day routine. She would take the kids to school, and Shelley came to really rely on her for a lot of fundamental things, especially once the relationship dissolved. And so she sort of knew. She knew the lay of the land in terms of the deterioration of the family and the relationship. And so when she comes that day, as she approaches the front door of the apartment with her grandson, she can sort of, it's odd to her that the door is open. She can hear some murmuring within the apartment. And then obviously once she sees the police officers inside, that was a clear sign that something was amiss. So she asks rather quickly, you know, where is Shelley? What's going on? And initially there was no response until finally Rod spoke and told her that Shelley was gone. And she was stunned. Obviously, this is someone that she had been with the night before. She had been with the kids, you know, not just the previous evening. And she had a cup of coffee in her hand from McDonald's. It was a cold day. And that fell from her hands, and it splattered across the wall. And she collapsed along with it and began crying. And after a while, when she sort of took stock and gathered herself and sort of to speak, she said it's not an accident. So obviously that was suggestive early on that there were suspicions as to what had taken place. Shelley was young and vibrant, and for her to die in such a sudden and abrupt manner in a bathtub was extraordinary, to put it mildly at that point.
You talk now, we go back and give the background of Shelley Minna Danishevsky, born in July 1962. Her dad, Joel, wife, Jaylene, Polish immigrants, living in Elizabeth, New Jersey. And father, Joel, is a rabbi, also a butcher. And he had a love of finance. Her sister that she's very close to is Eve. Tell us about the family. Tell us briefly about the accident that scarred Shelley and where she is at the time that she meets Rod Covlin in her life.
Mm-hmm. So Shelley was born to a religious Orthodox Jewish family, and sort of the patriarch was Joel, her father. He sort of came up the hard way. He initially became a butcher. He was a Jewish butcher, a kosher butcher, which actually requires some sort of particular set of skills in order to in order to perform that function in that culture. And he also, while doing so, his father was a rabbi, and he had always hoped to follow in his footsteps, and was a very religious man. But the work was difficult to find in the religious capacity, so he was sort of compelled to serve in this butcher role. But he sort of tired of that, and he would, when his day was over, he would walk around downtown Elizabeth, and there are banks there, and in most banks, especially back then, there was the stock ticker. And so here's this sort of this young man who had just come from butchering meat consumption, and he sees this rush of stock ticker numbers, and he's sort of intrigued by it, and that would sort of spark an interest in finance. And he obviously had a knowledge that this was related to Wall Street, and there were people made their fortunes in this manner one way or another. So he pursued that and would eventually earn a degree to that end, and quickly applied his what a pre-existing sort of facility with numbers and math, and he would earn a job on Wall Street and start doing very well there. Meanwhile, since his financial prospects were improving, he and his wife Jaylene had children, and Shelley was one of his two beloved daughters, and they were a very close-knit family, very sort of traditional Orthodox Jewish family. He was never one for sort of lavish luxury. Instead, he had the money to do it, but instead he really tried to instill in his kids sort of a sense of industry and work ethic and piety and family sort of as the bedrock of their lives and their foundation. And as far as we could discern, he had succeeded in doing so. This is a very tightly knit family. And to this, Shelley did have an accident, which Joel would blame himself for. When she was a little girl, they were having a dinner on a religious occasion at a friend's house. And there's an urn kept with hot water. And she tipped it over onto herself while the adults were in another room, and this it's called a samovar, and it's filled with scalding hot water that's normally used for tea, and it splashed all across her torso and would end up scarring her very badly. And Joel, her other relatives, would tell us, often blamed himself for this. I mean, she had to undergo skin grafts, and there was a lot of permanent scarring, so it wasn't sort of a brief episode in their life. Something that would sort of plague her and her sense of self-esteem, well into her teens and even sort of early sort of college years. And Joel, for that reason, since he did blame himself for not sort of protecting his little girl against this accident, unlike his other kids, who he was very demanding of in terms of their academic performance, he was a little more lax with Shelley. And so her performance in school wasn't as good, but they were reluctant to get on her about it because, again, there was a sort of underlying guilt. And his main concern was that she was comfortable and she was happy. And sometimes, as parents can tell you, that could lead to some bad habits because you're a little too permissive, and that has a negative consequence. But Shelley was also a little bit overweight because of this issue, the self-esteem issue and sort of sense of inadequacy. So in her high school years, she wasn't quite in the popular crowd. But when she got to college in Manhattan, she went to Pace University. Once she got there, she shed a lot of these issues and she lost a lot of weight. And she was more sociable, and partially one can assume that perhaps it's because she was sort of no longer under parental watch, and like anyone who's starting off in college, she was able to spread her wings a little bit. So she adjusted well. She accepted the scarring from this burn as just sort of something she can deal with and manage, make manageable. She lost a lot of weight, and her dormant beauty sort of burst to the fore, and she was well on her way. She graduated in finance and slowly worked her way up with her father's help in that world on Wall Street. But she did have a difficulty with sort of finding a suitable mate. Her sister, Eve, would eventually get married and have a child, and to a man they both really respected. But she, in that department, she was running into some complications, and the relationships would come and go, and it was starting to get a little concerned. She was getting older, into her later 20s and early 30s, and there had still, the husband had not yet appeared at this point. And she really, again, because of her own family background, you know, children, and that model was really prized. And there was a sense of, I don't know if desperation is too strong a word, but she knew that this was a void in her life that she really wanted to fill, especially with all of her siblings married, and she was the only one at this point who wasn't. And she would date frequently, but the mates weren't always of the highest caliber. That's what her family told us. And then one night she went to an event in the city and met Rod.
Yes, you talk about February 15th, 1998. Shelley calls her sister Eve and says, "I've met my soulmate. And we're going to Vegas to get married." Now, Eve knows that she hasn't had much luck and hasn't had the best choices in men either. Kind of ridiculous dates that she has witnessed. But she pleads with her to say, "Listen, don't do this to our parents. You know, think of mom and dad. It'll break their heart." So she reassures Eve that she's not going to go get married to him in Vegas that night. But she tells him about this guy, 6'2", muscular, martial arts, blue eyes, raised as a traditional Jewish person, and engineer degree. So he presented himself as a really good catch and a budding tech entrepreneur. So she was very, very excited about Rod Coughlin, wasn't she? Let's use this as an opportunity just to stop for a second for the messages from our sponsor, which is FabFitFun. FabFitFun Spring Box is centered around the theme Grow Forth, supporting self-care and self-growth in the new season ahead. My wife Lisa and I are planning to grow forth into the spring season by reconnecting with old friends and getting back into hobbies and activities that we plan to do outside. My wife Lisa was excited to get her FabFitFun spring box and wanting to get a head start this year on our garden, so she was anxious to get her LED indoor planner by Short Stories and get started planting seeds indoors for our garden this summer. Lisa loves all the FabFitFun items relating to skincare, like Grown Alchemist body cream with mandarin and rosemary leaf and Josie Moran 100% pure argan oil. Lisa loves her Super Eye Serum by Verso with Retinol 8. And Pure Iconic Glow Moisturizing Face and Body Dry Oil. Lisa literally relies on FabFitFun and all the marvelous health and beauty products they deliver right to our door. 20 female-founded brands are in the spring box this season. You can choose from a wide variety of products when you order. Receive seasonal must-haves without leaving home. This FabFitFun spring box is still exciting for Lisa to receive, even after receiving FabFitFun boxes for over 4 years. Lisa tells everyone she encounters about the amazing products and the incredible value and the perks of membership. Order your spring box today. Sign up now so you can snag amazing products like the LED Indoor Planner by Short Stories or Verso Super Eye Serum when you customize. Use coupon code MURDER at www.fabfitfun.com for $10 off your first box. That's use coupon code MURDER at www.fabfitfun.com for $10 off your first box.
Now, Salim, we were talking about she finally meets this person that she believes is her soulmate, as she described to her sister. But right away, when the sisters meet this dream guy, Rod, what is their first impression and why?
So Eve thought that odd, but again, the entire family was rooting for her to sort of finally settle down and have children, and she had sold his attributes with such enthusiasm to everyone that she was willing to sort of overlook it and chalk it up to maybe, you know, he's having a bad day or he's shy, something along those lines. So her initial instincts were that there was something a bit off, but it's something that they could get through.
Now, we have to compress this story to be able to explain this incredible twisting and turning story that it would seem from the introduction that we gave that the police, regardless of some of the evidence that they didn't collect and they didn't gather and there's a suspicion that they didn't have, that at some point they find out this information. So in this marriage, they have two children. And it lasts over 10 years. But right from that very first impression of the family about Rod and his desire to be a good husband to their sister, Shelley, there are signs right away. She's the breadwinner and he has some ideas about being a budding entrepreneur. However, he doesn't work and she works even harder. And those bad habits about him believing that he could be a backgammon champion. Tell us just a little bit about his character that very, very quickly comes into sight, and even the family notices some of the things that are just plain wrong about Rod Coughlin?
So on paper, he was impressive. He had all the right degrees. He was charming. He was a good conversationalist. He was witty. So on that surface level, he had promise. And his what Shelley had always assumed is that he would put these degrees to use. He's an Ivy League graduate, and that he would eventually make it somewhere in the tech field. That's where his interests were. And so the assumption was that at some point he would bring these talents to bear. But slowly, as the marriage progressed, she would notice that, you know, there's very little enthusiasm for full-time work. Now, she, like I said prior, she was now working on Wall Street in a very sort of lucrative position. She worked alongside her father and her sibling. And so she was bringing in plenty of money, and they lived comfortably. But again, the paychecks were only coming from her end. And he was increasingly focused not on gainful employment, but developing his skills in the game of backgammon, which played sort of which was an undercurrent through the book. He had a real affinity for the game, and there's a professional circuit. A lot of people don't know that, but it's something we discovered in sort of researching the book. But there's actually there's prize money to be had on the professional level. And so he would dedicate more and more of his time to pursuing that. And he was convinced that he would be able to produce sizable income for the family, you know, once he attained this sort of backgammon stardom. And at first, Shelley had sort of dismissed it as sort of a fancy that was a sort of thing that would eventually subside. But more and more, as the months and the years passed, it became something of an obsession. And he would travel constantly to these tournaments. It obviously wasn't. The winnings were occasional and largely insignificant, so the concern began to spiral in both Shelley and her family. Couldn't help noticing from afar that she was the one working while he was the one indulging in recreation, and that's when those concerns really started to surface.
You talk about backgammon too. He used that as a premise to philander with other women online, and she soon found out, whether he let her find out or she found out through an email, that he was basically having affairs or consorting with prostitutes, but he was definitely stepping out from her in this marriage. Along with that, the family noticed, and she definitely noticed, that he was berating her about her looks. In the beginning, he was a real charmer, giving her flowers and nothing but compliments, but now there was nothing but criticism. And so fast forward in this relationship, he really has a problem with looking at the obvious signs, as Eve tells her, look, are you crazy taking this guy back, considering the things that he has done to her, that he's said to her, that he's threatened her. So over this, not so quickly, but in that 10-year period, this dream marriage turned into a nightmare for Shelley. And she tells other people, friends. The nanny knows some things. She tells other friends. She confides in people. And she makes moves toward thinking that she needs to protect her children, to protect her finances, and to change her will. Tell us about how he responds to all of this and what she does in response to what he does to try to thwart her efforts.
Shelley was reluctant to surrender the marriage for many reasons. They had the children. She really did want to establish a harmonious home. But soon, you know, as the time ticked off, she realized that certain things weren't going to change. And obviously, the situation became untenable for her once the infidelity came to light, and it was widespread and constant. And at one point, he even suggested that they had an open marriage. And these were things that obviously Shelley had no interest in and did nothing other than drive her away. And eventually, she grew tired of a lot of this abuse. There would be verbal attacks, and Rod would yell at her on very limited grounds in public in front of her family. And, you know, her defenses wore away, and she finally decided she had had enough, and that her concern at this point was sort of expelling him, severing him from the will. She had a pretty sizable life insurance policies and other assets, and her concern was that he would somehow commandeer these funds at some point. So her goal was to meet with a lawyer and to write him out of her will, and then that would eventually free her from him completely and allow her to move on with her life. But obviously it didn't get that far.
Right. Now, this is New Year's Eve. Now, you take us back to the crime scene and also why there is a reasons for this investigation to eventually, because the family, again, pushes. And there is an interesting medical examiner named Hayes that goes against his superior named Hirsch and just won't let this case go, because what we hadn't mentioned is that this ME that initially came to that crime scene, what he was astonished at was there was red, and some of them an inch and a half in length, scratches on the lower half of Shelley's face, as well as contusion on her lip and bruises on her elbow and arm and various places. And he stuck with this and was instrumental in helping this case, because, again, another complication of this is the Orthodox Jewish religion, and also the idea that unless there's some incredible reason for desecration, as they call it, of this body, that they would not authorize an autopsy. So combined with the, I guess, the persuasiveness of Rod Coughlin, and also what seemingly ineptitude by the New York Police Department, that this idea that he had something to do with this, this ME Hayes was instrumental in keeping that investigation and that information alive, wasn't he?
Yes. So initially, after Shelley passed, they were faced with a decision. Her family was faced with a very serious decision and a very wrenching decision. They obviously had their suspicions about what took place that night. They knew the details of her personal life, her relationship with Rod. So they had their suspicions, but that competed against their religious beliefs, which in the Orthodox Jewish faith, autopsies are frowned upon because it's seen, like you had said, it's seen as a disturbance of the body prior to burial. And in order for the soul to transit to the afterlife in an orderly way, then you need the undisturbed corpse in order to do so. An autopsy obviously is very invasive, and that procedure is, in their mind, complicates that. So they had to deal with this issue, and Joel, Shelley's father, she sought out sort of higher religious authorities and another rabbi to counsel him on what to do. At first, you know, since they had this difficult decision to make, the rabbi initially agreed to do it, because Joel explained the circumstances of Shelley's death, and this other rabbi said, you know what, if there's any situation that would call for it, that this would be it. But there was yet another wrinkle in this case that would prevent that autopsy from taking place. So before Hayes, who had been seeking to do it because he had a suspicion, Hayes, the New York City medical examiner, before he could perform the procedure, there is a group in a Jewish, Orthodox Jewish group called Misaskim. And their role is to assist Orthodox Jewish families in dealing with the aftermath of a death. So they assist with the grieving, so they help with sort of the grieving process. They really do whatever family needs, and they're seen as sort of a vital service. But they are especially opposed to autopsies on religious grounds for the reasons that I mentioned previously. And they had a representative who sort of held himself out as a rabbi, a member of the Saskim, who was told about the death of Shelley, and he knew that this was a member of the Orthodox Jewish community. And he went to the scene of the crime, and he was admitted to it, and his role there as a representative of this group is to collect any sort of bodily fluids, anything that should be buried along with Shelley. So right. He goes to the scene, and that's a whole other complicating factor why he was given such free rein to go in, but he managed to convince them that he was a religious representative, and he was admitted. So once he had his rounds in the apartment, the crime scene, he called the family, and once Joel told them that they would plan on an autopsy, he vigorously opposed it and told them, no, this was an accident. I talked to some of the detectives in the case, and they assured me there's no foul play here. Don't do it. You know, don't do it. So Joel, and you can imagine how difficult a decision this was for him, sitting there at his dining room table, struggling with this dilemma. You know, on the one hand, his daughter is dead, and he has his suspicions about her husband. And on the other hand, he has these religious pressures on the other side. So it was really a very difficult and challenging position for him to be in. And he relented, and he called it off. The Hayes, the medical examiner, was literally, from what he said at trial, was about to make the initial incisions that, you know, would have maybe brought them closer to the truth. And he got a call, and they said, no, put it down. We object. And he was bound to that.
Now, we have to talk about Deborah Olis, because after this fatality, after Shelley's death, he goes on dating, meeting many people online, and goes to attorneys for period of time anyway, but he meets somebody named Deborah Olis, and he's foolish enough to confide in her along the way. And when it comes time for him to be indicted, she has some concerns about some of the things he has already said to her. So she starts recording some of these conversations, and eventually she goes to a detective that had initially spoken to her, and she has a pang of conscience and contacts this detective Mooney to say some things. We have to sort of jump ahead to the investigation that finally looks at the same evidence and then calls for an exhumation of the body. Tell us about that.
All throughout this process, so it's a long period of time here that we're talking about, that obviously we're having to condense, but all throughout this period, the family has their suspicions, and especially Eve and her husband, Mark. They were growing increasingly frustrated with what was happening. They had suspicions about Rod's involvement, and they were unrelenting in their pressure on the Manhattan District Attorney's Office and anyone they could talk to, NYPD, to keep pressing and keep pressing on the case. And finally, these efforts came to a head. And again, what was still a very difficult decision for the family, they decided that an exhumation was unavoidable at this point, and that exhumation would allow for an autopsy. And as more and more evidence leaked out as to sort of Rod's potential involvement in Shelley's killing, it became too much for them to sort of ignore. And the exhumation was, they agreed Hayes, who was sort of scuttled in his previous attempt to conduct the autopsy, was now able to do so.
When he did that initial examination, he still could see. It was 2 months later, but she was fairly, it wasn't so decomposed because it had been winter. He could still see those scratches on her face. But a very, very interesting thing happened, and it's a break in the case. What did he find in his more thorough examination via the autopsy?
So the discovery that essentially turned the case during Hayes' autopsy was a broken hyoid bone in the neck, which is a very difficult bone to break in sort of a random manner, and it's often suggestive of something else.
Mm-hmm.
When Hayes made this discovery, there were some other signs too, now that he was really able to conduct a comprehensive, investigation, comprehensive autopsy. There were marks in her eyes, little sort of, it's called the tachyi. And those are also suggestive, indicative of, it indicates a squeezing of the neck that pops vessels in the eyes. And these are very difficult to see. They're very small. So these are two elements that Hayes found in his autopsy. And at that point, the manner of death was changed on the death certificate, and in place of whatever benign word was there previously was replaced with homicide. And that is what really set things, accelerated the entire story at that point.
Now, once they had that, these same investigators, very interesting, a guy named Rode Armitil, maybe mispronouncing.
Rodermill.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This guy was instrumental in ignoring evidence at that crime scene and was adamant that this was an accident to certain people. And this guy has to go back, and they have to look at and have to do a search warrant again at the previous, at Shelley's apartment. But they also, and you can tell us what they find at the apartment, but also they did gather devices from Deborah Olis and also the recordings that she had made and any kind of messages between them. So a gathering of all kinds of cell phone information takes them a year and a half to process and analyze all this. Meanwhile, Rod sits in jail on bail eventually, or without bail, pardon me, eventually. So tell us what else they find at this, interestingly, at the crime scene, especially regarding, I think, an issue that's super important, I thought, was the issue of the door and him having any access door, that apartment that he was not supposed to be having any access to.
Yeah, there was one scene that Mark and Eve recalled soon after, when Rod was still free. They had gone to Shelley's home, to the apartment and were having trouble opening the lock. This is after her passing, obviously. They were having trouble opening the lock, and he appeared because he was across the hall, and he came and really quickly opened it, was able to open it. So they obviously, when they were, in retrospect, they were surprised by this, because how would he have such familiarity and ability to negotiate this troublesome lock? So that obviously, in their mind, and this is something that they told us later, was some that heightened their suspicions. And you mentioned the Detective Rodermel. So because the homicide determination was sort of belated because of the delayed autopsy and so forth, he had to sort of go and cover ground that really probably should have been covered initially. So this is really sort of basic steps, from getting surveillance cameras from the building to talking to people in the building. I mean, things that you would have thought would have been done in the first sort of 48 hours after this happened. But they had to go back, in essence, because of this lengthy delay, and go over what they should have done previously. Now, this would hamper the prosecution's case in court, because, you know, a mishandled police investigation compromises the case pretty severely. And so that was also an issue. But on the other hand, the prosecution benefited, as you said, from this trove that they were provided by Deborah, and came to trust her and would confide in her many, many different things. And a lot of them would ultimately become damaging and probably pivotal at trial. And she turned over devices to NYPD. She would say later that she had her suspicions about Rod, and she was angry also about some of the mistreatment that she suffered at his hands. So the prosecution sort of had some benefits when this finally hit the courtroom, and they also had some disadvantages.
It was interesting, too. You outline everything that goes on, and interestingly, the evidence that was immaterial and deemed prejudicial for the jury. And that's some things like, and we had talked about it in the introduction, about his daughter and his plans. This was discussed with Deborah Olis, and about plans for Anna to accuse her own grandfather of raping her. And as we didn't mention in this, at the very beginning of the book, Rod is successful with this same kind of baseless allegation to help his father out many, many years before. So it's very interesting. Mm-hmm. This pattern is repeated, and a couple times here in his quest to try to evade prosecution in this. But he definitely talks to Anna also about, unbelievably, confessing to the murder of her own mother because she won't do much time. And so these kinds of things obviously are so prejudicial to a jury that they would be convicted just hearing these things. But all kinds of other damaging and incriminating evidence was allowed at this trial, wasn't it? And
right. So in the end, it was a largely circumstantial case.
Sure.
And the prosecution knew that there was no smoking gun. There was the physical evidence was very limited. So the prosecution was, they had a hill to climb. And in order to get them up that hill, they relied largely on this sort of secondary or unrelated material related to Rod's character and these various schemes that he hatched in relation to his parents, to his daughter, and as you stated, these are aspects of someone's character that would not help them in front of a jury. And the defense knew this, and the prosecution knew this, so the case would eventually turn on what was admitted and what wasn't. And the prosecutor, Matthew Bogdanos, was adamant about getting in as much as he could in order to show the jury that he was a man who had the capacity and the moral deficiencies to commit what he is accused of, and because he had to, because there was really not much else that he could lean on to secure a conviction. And on the other end, the defense attorney, Robert Gottlieb, would argue that, you can't find someone guilty of murder because they are of poor character. And he leaned on this as best he could in making his arguments, but enough made it in. And we are going to sort of look at the final result that would convince the jury that he did it.
What was his sentence?
His sentence?
Mm-hmm. Second degree murder.
Well, oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, he was convicted of murder, and he got the 25 years to life. You got what you get in New York for a crime of this magnitude, and that's where he is now.
It's heart-wrenching near the end of this book, because we forget. Well, I don't know if we forget, because we're reminded in your very, very sensitive book that Anna is one heck of a victim here, obviously. And there's victim impact statements made by the Danishevskys about their loss of their daughter and sister, friend, and but Anna makes her own heartfelt statement at court, doesn't she?
Yes, that was a pretty unforgettable moment during this trial. Now, Anna was close to her father, and by many accounts, he's a good dad, and he was good, not only to her, but to her brother Miles, and was very involved with their life, and was doting, and then helped them with their homework, and did all the things that, that many good parents do. But it was a question as to her position on his guilt, because she never appeared at trial. She was never in the gallery, and she was deemed too sort of unsteady a witness, I think, for either side to call to the stand. So there was a question mark sort of hovering over the trial as to sort of Anna's position. She was never there. And finally, it was revealed to court that she was going to have a statement read in court. Statement was read by Rod's mother, so her grandmother. They also, Rod's parents also play a pretty integral role in all this, but we only have an hour, so it's probably more than we can fit in. But yes, Anna spoke through a statement read by her grandmother. She completely sided with her father and said that she did not believe that he committed this act and was in staunchly defended him. And it was a pretty breathtaking moment during the trial. And it's one of the portions and the reaction to the book thus far that has really sort of has touched people. And it's mine. Dan, it should pop up. And Dan, I just want to thank you for giving us the opportunity here and doing a really good job. So we appreciate it.
Thank you so much for this interview. It's an incredible book. And thank you so much for this interview. You have a great evening.
Great.
Good night.
Thank you, Dan.
In 2017, when a trans woman disappears from the village, alarm bells go off.
Girls go missing. Girls end up dead.
So her friends decide enough is enough.
Justice for Laura!
This is the story of what happens when sex workers and trans people stand up to fight the system that failed them. I'm Justin Ling, and this is The Village, Season 2. Available now on the CBC Listen app and everywhere you get your podcasts.